1994 at our one location in an old auto parts store, we have established 10 sites in Manhattan and one in Wamego, and we serve over 2,700 members a year. So why does our program matter? Studies show that during out-of-school hours, youth are most likely to get into trouble, be a victim of crime, engage in negative behaviors, and probably experiment with drugs and alcohol as well. So what we do is provide, again, those children a safe, structured environment, engaging activities where they can reap those benefits and improve their attitudes towards school, more positive social behaviors, and better grades. I brought a copy of our annual report that I will leave here for you. Again, we have 10 locations, 2,728 members that we serve annually, and 879 children are served daily, 380 days a year. But that includes summer and then the in-service days and those type things, so it kind of overlaps a little bit. Our focus and our programs include academics, healthy lifestyles, and that includes both physical activities, nutrition, positive behaviors not involving drugs or alcohol, and good character and citizenship. So how we will use this donation today is that we give a lot of scholarships out to those families that are in need. That is a huge portion of what we do. And in 2017, we saw a 220% increase in scholarship requests and awarded over $90,000 worth of program scholarships to 250-plus members. So it really is a huge, huge part of what we do day in and day out to ensure that these kids have a safe place to go after school and before. These scholarships allow low-income families to not have to worry about their children before and after school and our summer program fees, ensures that their child has a safe, supervised environment while they are at work. Again, on behalf of the Boys and Girls Club, I'd like to thank you for supporting Manhattan kids and teens. And with your gift today, we can move the needle for youth in the Manhattan area, creating real opportunity based on their potential and not their family's income. I do have some brochures here that tells you a little bit more about our program and the different sites that we serve, so I'll leave those as well if you'd like to grab one. And again, this is our annual report, and I just had one of those. So thank you again for your time, and mothers, happy Mother's Day to you. And we really appreciate you having us here today.
Thank you. Matthew. Each week we share the joys and sorrows of our hearts during our services as a reminder of how we share life together and receive consolation and congratulations from each other. We will never know all the ups and downs of one another's lives. We can glimpse and gain some intimacy and connection, though. And today, we're gifted with a little bat sculpture from Sarah, who finds joy in bats. Kathleen Tanona comes with us today to us today with a sorrow. Her brother has a long-time drug problem and is in a stressful time right now, and her mother is particularly stressed about it. And so she's sad for her mother today on Mother's Day to be dealing with that. Anna has both a joy and a sorrow. Her sorrow is that her computer was hacked, but her joy also relates to a mother. Without even thinking, she says, "I was prompted to look into my mother's eyes in her portrait, and I remembered aloud with her how I looked, as I looked, how many good laughs we'd had, what a fine and good woman she is, for her soul is still very much with me." Many of us today, Mother's Day awakens joys and concerns depending on our personal experience of motherhood, whether or not we are mothers, how joy and sorrow are woven fine within our experience. All that shapes our response and reactions to Mother's Day. And to honor the mothers among us, I offer the adapted words of UU Minister Suzelle Lynch. Mothers are the ones who give us life, not only physical life. They are the good persons who are with us, and with their gentleness or strength, they hold us up when we are sinking down. Mothers take pride in our success. They call us to do our best and to see beyond who we are now so that we might become our best selves. Mothers are the ones who celebrate our growth and help us figure out what went wrong when we fail. Mothers are the ones whose tenderness gives us courage, the ones whose examples and mentoring help us take risks, the ones who show us how to laugh and to cry, the ones who listen to us and who know that their lives do not always match the advice that they give. Mothers are the ones who teach us the ways of compassion. Mother's Day is a day to celebrate and to be glad and grateful for mothers. So goes the joy part. Suzelle goes on to acknowledge the sorrow. But for many of us, Mother's Day brings sadness or mixed feelings as well. And so we honor those feelings too. Let us remember those who have lost their mothers and those mothers who needed to allow their children to be adopted by others. Let us remember the women who want so much to conceive and bear children and cannot, and the women who face the painful choice to end a pregnancy. Let us remember the women who mother other mothers' children as stepmothers, and women who have lost children of any age to death or to estrangement. Let us respond to our world, our fragile, lovely, challenging world, with beauty and strength and a reaching out of hearts and hands. And so we hold the tensions close to our hearts and honor the mothers among us and acknowledge those for whom Mother's Day brings up challenging feelings. And one other sadness of Mother's Day that I have to put forward this morning, and that is that many mothers in our country encounter systemic discrimination. Immigrants who are threatened increasingly with having their families torn apart. Mothers in jail, especially black and brown mothers who cannot get bond, and the incredible number of mothers and children in poverty. The majority of homeless families are made of mothers and children. At all income levels, women continue to make much less money than men and suffer from assumptions in the workplace that prevent them from moving ahead. And oftentimes those are tied in with motherhood. More than one child in five lives in poverty in this country, and families headed by singles mothers are more than 14% more likely to be poor than other families. People who have children at an early age also increase their risk of poverty. However, it's not personal decisions that have the greatest influence here, at least according to sociologists. To quote Brady, Finnegan, and Hubgen, three of those sociologists, did the 1996 welfare reform, which made social policies less generous for single mothers, cause a large reduction in single motherhood? No. Do rich democracies with more generous policies for single mothers have more single mothers? No. Do rich democracies with higher penalties for single motherhood have fewer single mothers? No. So a key problem in our culture is the assumption that these are personal issues, that poverty is the fault of people who are poor. And no doubt poverty is complicated, but the evidence shows that supporting people in poverty is more likely to help them live better lives than punishing them. Living wages, safe and affordable housing, expansion of Medicaid, equal pay for equal work, and guaranteed annual income would go a long way toward changing the world for women and children in poverty. And those are among the demands of the Poor People's Campaign, whose 40 days of action launch tomorrow, with direct action taking place in 40 state capitals and in Washington, D.C. I will be in Topeka tomorrow, and this is part of the reason why. In each of the next 6 weeks, we'll have brief comments during our service on the themes that the Poor People's Campaign is lifting up. And today, we've considered women and children in poverty. And other weeks, you'll hear from people other than me. Stay tuned and talk with me if you're interested in those 40 days of action.
Every day is an opportunity to create and define who we are. The French existentialist philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre wrote, quote, "There is only one day left, always starting over. It is given to us at dawn and taken away from us at dusk," end quote. Sartre was an atheist, and like the rabbis, he saw a connection between the beginning of each day and the renewal of one's mind. Existentialism is based on the idea that we first exist. Our life's meaning is not pre-planned. Rather, it is determined by each and every decision we make. Sartre continued, "As far as people go, it is not what they are that interests me, but what they can become," end quote. To hope is to wake up in the morning and begin one's day. To hope is to be aware of what is happening now while creatively imagining new possibilities and considering how one might make them realities. So please rise in body and or spirit. Join us in singing hymn 1017, Building a New Way. It's in the teal hymnal. You'll find. Teal.
if we did that a couple more times, we might get it. There. You may have heard the story of King John Sigismund of Transylvania in the 16th century. He and his mother, Queen Isabella, I have a slide there, who was the regent. Queen Isabella was the regent before he came of age. They were the only Unitarian royal rulers in history, and their Unitarianism showed. In the midst of the tumultuous and dangerous Reformation, when people were literally killed over religion, they issued edicts of religious toleration that allowed people to worship as they pleased rather than according to the religious biases of the king or the queen. And that period of toleration in Transylvania was relatively brief, though, because Sigismund's successor, Stephen Bartori, was not only dismissed most of the Unitarians who were part of the court, but he also imposed standards for religious doctrine, saying each recognized religion, including Unitarianism, needed to have fixed ideas and dogma. Well, Francis David, next slide, was a Unitarian priest who had been a key advisor to Sigismund and particularly to Isabella, and got himself in trouble. He kept looking at his Unitarian religious beliefs and allowing them to evolve. After all, he had started as a Catholic priest. He became a Lutheran. Then he became a Unitarian. He wasn't about to stop thinking. He questioned doctrines concerning the Lord's Supper, infant baptism, predestination, and the worship of Jesus. And ultimately, he died in prison after being found guilty of innovation in religion. Guilty of innovation in religion. Have you ever been guilty of innovation in religion? Most you use have. We have found new ways of thinking, new ways of understanding, new ideas and themes that shape and give meaning to our lives. The basis of Unitarian Universalism is innovation in religion. We are compelled not to a particular belief, but to keep thinking, to keep changing our minds. And through the ages, most Unitarians, Universalists, and UUs have been guilty of innovation. One of them was Norbert Chapek, on the next slide there, who was the creator of the flower ceremony that we're enacting today. Chapek brought Unitarianism to Prague in the 1920s. He was a little like David in that he had begun as a Catholic and he became a Baptist, and in the U.S. for seminary, he converted to Unitarianism. And his parishioners, so he went back to Prague then and established a Unitarian church. His parishioners in Prague had rejected their past religious trappings and ceremonies, but they wanted something to participate in together that would involve beauty and shared experience. So he created this ritual, a simple ritual of gathering together flowers and then dispersing them again. And he created meaning for it, describing how the individual flowers represent the individual people and what the individual people bring and how each takes away something different, something that they have gained from one another, from being together, a different flower. And the ceremony has evolved through the last nearly 100 years and come to be enacted in many Unitarian and UU congregations throughout the world, as we are doing today. Chapek filled a spiritual need with a creative solution. And like David, he ended up martyred, dying in a Nazi concentration camp for daring to challenge the authorities of that time. He, too, was guilty of innovation. Innovation is another name for this month's theme, creativity. Because our religious tradition is grounded in innovation, we could say that we are a people of creativity. Whether you believe it or not, you are creative. There's proof you helped to work on this little masterpiece of flower art before you. Now, artists, whether amateur or professional, recognize that they are creative. Last week I said a bit about how creativity is a lot larger than the arts. So we've expanded creativity to everyday problem solving and just now to creativity or innovation in religion, innovation in finding meaning in our lives. We are a people of creativity. However, we can't simply cling to that definition unless we understand more deeply what it demands of us. If we want to hold that identity as people of creativity, we have to continue to create, continue to evolve in thoughts and feelings and understandings and practices, and continue to create conditions that will nurture creativity. So what do we need to help creativity happen? There's a belief that creativity comes on its own schedule, that we can't induce it. We see it in the tradition of the Muses, who we have another picture of. Originally, they were the Greek goddesses of literature, the arts, and sciences. These nine daughters of Zeus and Mnemosyne each had their specialties, including epic and lyric poetry, rhetoric, song, musical instruments like guitar and harp and flute, tragedy and comedy, hymns, dance, history, geometry, grammar, agriculture, architecture, astronomy. You can see the diversity of where creativity might strike. Now, the idea of the Muses persisted over time, even as Western people changed their ideas about religion, because the source of creative ideas can be so elusive. Where does that precious notion come from? How does it get into our heads? It's as if from nowhere sometimes. It just pops into your head. Or you work and work and work and work at it and it doesn't come until it does. I watched David Letterman's interview of Jay-Z, slide, and they talked about it in terms of jokes and music. Sometimes, said Jay-Z, the song comes into your head almost fully formed and it takes 3 minutes to write it. And other times you have this idea and you pound on it and pound on it, but it isn't what you were going for and what you envisioned and what you wanted. And Jay-Z even said that one of his hit songs was that, and he's still unhappy with it. He's probably making enough money to help make up for that sum, but he never did make it what he wanted it to be. Creativity can frustrate sometimes as much as it inspires. So when we ask what we need to do to nurture creativity, to invite the Muses to visit, the answer is not easy and never foolproof. People were looking over it long before the Greeks, I think. But they've been doing it for long enough that we have some ideas of conditions that support and nurture and encourage creativity. First, you got to throw the critic out. Every discussion I've ever heard of writer's block says your inner critic has got to go if you're going to create. And some of us have really strong inner critics. And some of us have a full stable of them. There's the one that cares about what other people think. Oh, this will never go over. No one will like it, buy it, publish it, whatever. And then there's the one who's concerned with order. That's not a pure rhyme. Those colors don't go together. And then there's the one who sets impossibly high standards. That's not your best work. You'll never be as good as your brother. And there's the one who doesn't really like us as a person, the one with all those messages about being stupid or unworthy or unoriginal. You all have your own inner critics. You know who they are, what their different personalities are, what they say to you. And remember, creativity is not restricted to the arts. So these critics don't just emerge when we're painting or writing or composing. They infect the rest of our lives when we're problem solving or making dinner or working or playing. They nix our ideas all the time, stymieing our efforts to be our real selves, our creative selves. And I don't say they have no role. We do sometimes need to censor ourselves and consider other people's ideas, consider order, those sorts of things. There are some valid points, though we might want to get a restraining order on that inner critic who really doesn't like us as a person. So whenever those inner critics' messages pop into our brains, we may need to simply set them aside as you would thoughts or feelings that came to you during meditation. Let them drift off like the cloud in the slide, obscuring the sky. Let the clouds just drift away, or like the leaves float down a stream. Let them go. If the critiques are persistent, we may need to hold those critical messages up to the light and see if they are even true, if they are appropriate to the moment, and if they are helpful. If not, set them aside for good. Say, "Thanks very much for your concern, critic, but I really don't need that message right now." Whew. Inner critics are not all that we need to let go of. Besides judgment of our ideas, we need to let go of expectations and of the conventional. Unoriginal ideas will come, and those old ideas have persisted for a reason, because there's some truth there. There's something there that worked. But if we're too attached to those ideas, we don't let new ones, perhaps more appropriate to new circumstances, get a chance. It's kind of like that huge tree whose shade keeps seedlings from growing. Of course, original ideas aren't necessarily better than the old one. Old ones are tried and true. They have a track record. Old ideas give us the illusion that they're working when they're really worn out and used up, like a favorite comfy pair of shoes that doesn't really have arch support anymore and looks downright scruffy. They've outlived their usefulness, but it's hard to let go of them. And who knows about this new thing? It might fail. It might be a mistake. Fear is the real enemy of creativity. Fear motivates all those inner critics, and it compels us to hold on to those old, worn-out ideas. Catherine Butler Hathaway was a 20th century writer and memoirist whose fight against spinal tuberculosis shaped her life. And she talked about fear and creativity. She wrote, "I invented this rule for myself to be applied to every decision I might have to make in the future. I would sort out all the arguments and see which belonged to fear and which to creativeness. And with all other things being equal, I would make the decision that had the larger number of creative reasons on its side. I think it must be a rule something like this that makes jonquils and crocuses come pushing through cold mud." So one of the things that creativity requires is courage to face fear, particularly that courage to fail. A creative idea has to be able to be tried and fall on its face and not work. Out of that failure may come the perfect answer, because creativity is as much, if not more, about process as it is about result. There's an artist named Deborah Jones Buck who represents this more than anyone else, perhaps. She prepares a canvas and paints it. And then once the paint is dry, she paints over it something completely different. And she might paint 5 or 6 paintings on top of each other. It's as if she has all these images that have to get out, and she paints them. And once they're painted, they have no more value. It's about the process. Or consider the Buddhist monks who laboriously create beautiful and elaborate sand mandalas. I've seen them work at it. These orange-clad monks who take painstaking care as they drizzle grains of colored sand into carefully designed patterns. And when it's completed, it's wiped away and the sand thrown into the river. The transience of beauty and creativity. Focus on process alone can be really hard for those of us who've been trained to value results. We want a completed product that fits with our ideas of what it ought to be. Losing ourselves in process may not create the perfect result. And yet, if we have an expectation of perfection, fail we will. We gradually learn it's better not to try and to let only a small group of elites create our music, our stories, our clothes, our lives. Perfectionism pushes us toward conventional choices, safe choices, away from originality, away from risk. And I've heard perfectionism critiqued as an aspect of white supremacy. And while accepting the truth in that, I had to struggle with what was underlying that, what made it true. And what I've come to understand is that a standard of perfection makes people afraid to try, except for a few who are extraordinary either in their talent or in their privilege, in their self-confidence. Perfectionism is about discouraging people from making mistakes, really about discouraging people from trying, because we have to make mistakes to learn. Perfectionism keeps people in a trap of fear and reticence. Creativity demands mistakes. I once heard a jazz artist describe how he thought that jazz began. Maybe there was a musician, he said, who went out partying and drinking on Saturday night. None of our musicians, I'm sure. But he showed up on Sunday morning to play at church. A little worse for the wear, his fingers stumbled from time to time, making little errors, a little dissonance, a little syncopation. And then he wove them into the music as he played. And voila, jazz. Mistakes bring another opportunity to try something new and different rather than tread the trodden path. As Leonard Cohen wrote, there's a crack in everything. It lets the light shine in. Most artists claim, though, that a structure within which to create is useful. Sonatas, haiku, limericks, novellas all give structure. Time signatures, schools of painting, choreography, mind maps, all forms of structure. The structure can be simple or complex, rigid or flexible. Structure gives a starting point. And what the genius creators know is that once you know the forms, you can set them aside. Picasso, as a child, did amazingly accurate drawings. And because he could do that, he could set it aside to become the genius he did. And so finally, the biggest thing we need for creativity is openness. Not only the open-mindedness I spoke of in relation to letting go of critics and expectations, but openness in time and space, unscheduled time for dreaming and scheming. Quiet time for the mind to wander. In short, for creativity, we need emptiness. Poet Samantha Reynolds writes, "Hollow out your memories until you get to the dustiest bins jammed into the corners of your spirit. Forgotten weekends. Beliefs you thought were glued on tight the way shame ignites. Only dormant, never gone. How does it all fit the wake of a life? So much history spooled inside us, you wonder what the point is in all this remembering. But a tree does more than reach for the sun. It feasts on the rain, sucking it like a straw from its darkest buried roots. This is where creativity hides. Wearing the masks of your old stories, words and images, the debris of time waiting to be stitched into art. The demands of life are great on all of us these days, some more than others, depending on life circumstances. Most of us, though, could use a little extra time to dream, even if it's 10 minutes in line at the grocery store. There are a couple simple little creativity exercises that I've found useful in different settings. One is asking, what if? What if? What if the color blue disappeared? What if the lights went out? What if I took her left turn here? What if the person who disagrees with me is right? What if my guesses about who that person is are wrong? What if can apply and be useful in a lot of different settings? And the other creativity exercise I like to apply is try another way. Now, this applies particularly well in situations where the tried and true is not working, whether it's opening a jar or navigating a difficult relationship. A lot of times we get in those places and we just keep trying the same way, what we've known. Maybe we just need to try another way. Doesn't even matter what it is. Try something different. You don't need an argument for trying something different. You just need to try something different, something creative. So I leave you with words from Richard Rohr. Feel at home in the universe. Study it. Try to understand at least some of its innumerable marvels, including ourselves, who are more and more capable of this understanding. Marvel at that. Rejoice in the cosmos. In spite of all its hurtful ways, look at what it has done, is doing, is capable of doing. And be active in it. Contribute to it. Participate in the building, in the artwork, in the healing, in the understanding. This is where reality is. You yourself are both a member of the finite and a member of the infinite. You are a participant in the life cycle, for you are doing the incarnating and the creating and the realizing and the rejoicing. God's ecstasy, Rohr says, creates the world, and the world's ecstasy realizes God. So it's now time to complete our flower ceremony, and as we sing our closing hymn, number 64, during the hymn, come up, and if we leave the lights down, we can see the words, so you can even come up and take a flower and not lose track of the hymnal, right? It could happen. We'll see how it works. So during the hymn, come up and select a flower. And if you need assistance to get a flower, raise your hand. And if you didn't bring a flower, there are extras, so be sure to take home a flower. So our hymn, number 64, stand as you wish and come up and get a flower as you wish. May the flower you have chosen remind you of the blessings you receive from those gathered here. May it remind you of the beauty of the earth, of the natural world, and all the gifts that our human, animal, and plant companions share with us. May it remind you of the artwork we created here together and the art we create together week after week, the art of creating community. Go in peace.